Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. We're excited to announce that we will now be releasing these episodes every week on Wednesday morning. The best way to support us is by clicking subscribe and taking a moment to rate the podcast wherever you listen. If you'd like to support our efforts to keep the nonprofit Meditation Center open in Nashville, you can donate via the Venmo app by sending your donation to @WildHeartNashville. Or you can go to wildheartmeditationcenter.org and click the donate tab.
We also want to announce an upcoming residential retreat, which will be happening in May in North Carolina, May 24th to May 31st. You can find out more information about this retreat at heartwoodrefuge.org.
Thanks for listening.
Hey everyone, this is a Dharma talk that was given during a Wild Heart dedicated practitioners group that we wanted to share with you. You'll hear that the podcast episode is a little bit different than usual. I'm giving an introduction to the topic of renunciation, and then our guest teacher, Martine Batchelor, is sharing her experience with it. I hope you enjoy. Renunciation is going to be our focus. It falls under the second factor of the Buddha's Eightfold Path. The second factor is wise intention, which is really the path factor that is focused on shaping wholesome motivations, which influence how we move through the world. It's about aligning our motivations, our mental attitudes, in some ways our perceptions with our values. It's about aligning our motivations with wise view, which is the first factor of the Buddha's Eightfold Path. And putting it simply, intention is really the motivation behind our actions. It's the starting in the mind, the mental attitude or the movement of the mind that influences how we speak and how we act. So there are three types of wise intention in the Buddhist path. There is the intention towards goodwill, which is metta, loving kindness, friendliness, the intention of compassion, as non-harming, refraining from cruelty. And then there's the intention of renunciation, letting go of what's not serving our happiness and the happiness of others. So this can be renunciation on many levels. It can be breaking free from destructive habits, behaviors. It can be breaking free from destructive mental habits, from our communication habits and patterns. All sorts of things, but it's a very nuanced practice. And so I wanted to offer, as we dive into this practice together, a little bit of reflection from Bhikkhu Bodhi, something that I read often when I'm talking about renunciation. He says, so the problem arises of how to break the shackles of craving and clinging. The Buddha does not offer as a solution the method of repression, which is the attempt to drive our desire away with a mind full of fear and loathing. This approach does not resolve the problem, but only pushes it below the surface where it continues to thrive. The tool the Buddha holds out to free the mind from craving and clinging is understanding. Real renunciation is not a matter of compelling ourselves to give up things still inwardly cherished, but of changing our perspective on them so they no longer bind us. When we understand the nature of our craving and clinging, when we investigate it closely with keen attention, the craving and the clinging fall away by themselves without the need for struggle.
Personally, I think what is interesting with renunciation is that you have these two aspects. One aspect is what I call it happens by itself. And another aspect, yes, we need to maybe intentionally restrain ourselves, actually. Or we need intentionally, in a way, to let go. But my first experience of renunciation was many, many, many years ago when I was a nun, a Buddhist nun in Korea. And I was in a taxi and we were driving through Seoul, a very dense traffic. And the fellow was just amazed that I was a Westerner who was a Buddhist nun. So first he was amazed I was a nun, and secondly that I was a Westerner who was a nun. And so he was driving and he kept turning towards me, which I found was a little dangerous. And he would say, "Wow, this is amazing. You are a nun. Wow, such amazing renunciation. Wow, you're not smoking. Wow, you're not drinking. Wow, you're not eating meat. Wow, you don't have a wife. Wow, you don't go kind of to clubs and things." So he was very impressed by my renunciation. And me, I was sitting there thinking, but I don't want any of this. Like for me, it sounded like no renunciation, because I did not want to smoke, to drink. I did not want to have a partner. I did not want to go to club, and so on and so forth. So it was very interesting to have like this really two perspective. Him thinking, wow, this is amazing. I could never do it. And me actually thinking, wow, this is so easy, because I don't want these things anyway. And that's when I realized that the way we look at renunciation can be from so many different angles. That what somebody might think is a great renunciation, for you, it's the easiest thing to do. So I think there is this aspect that sometimes we used to like certain things, or we used to want certain things, or we used to be upset about certain things. And then suddenly, it doesn't have any pull. It doesn't, it's not attractive. It's not upsetting. And it's like, and then people are really amazed. Oh, you don't want that. Oh, you're not upset by that. Because, no. Because I am not grasping, I am not identifying, I don't put it as something that if I don't have it, then my life really would be terrible. So I find that interesting to see what is it that might look like a renunciation, but actually it's more like a dropping away. Or it could also be something you never wanted anyway, like it was in my case in that taxi. But of course, we also, at time, and I think that's where the practice comes in, the practice of awareness, the practice of mindfulness. Because what is, in a way, the practice about? The practice, I would say, the practice of meditation, the practice of the path, is about, I would say, causing the least harm that we can. I mean, to me, this would be one of my points, to cause the least harm that I can, to cause the least suffering that I can for myself and for others. And so then, this is interesting in terms of renunciation, because sometimes we actually grasp at something that can be harmful. And this is weird. Why would I grasp at something that is harmful? Often because of habits, often because of survival mechanism. This is a way we have learned over time to be in the world. And so we have this mechanism which can be harmful for ourselves and others. But in order to renounce the mechanism in a way, first we have to see how harmful it is. But that's not enough. It's also the fact that we can, in a way, replace them by something else. Because I think just stopping something is not going to deal with the survival mechanism which evolved for, I would generally say, good reason. So in a way, how can we move to something which is harmful, to something which is harmless, and which will work? Because I think this is the point. You stop doing something, but can you replace it by something else? So in a way, the first thing that can happen, can help us with the mindfulness, awareness, is in a way to see the danger. There is this wonderful sutta, the Vitaka Santana Sutta, and one of the things they say, the kind of the method to try not to cause harm to ourselves and others, is in a way to see the danger of the thought, to see the danger of going that way. And what is interesting there is that in a way the Buddha is saying, well, yes, you could react this way. You can start down this slope, but be careful. If you go down this slope, is it going to take you to a place which is really harmful? And then it gets very painful. And it might be easier to not go there at the beginning than when you're really stuck there. And so in a way, recognizing, oh, if I go down that way, and this is something I recognized long ago, what I would call the poor me syndrome. That, and often I would say it kind of comes with an unpleasant tonality, if you are familiar with that idea of tonality, feeling tones, Vedana, V-E-D-A-N-A. And so, I mean, a very little example I can give is you're waiting for somebody. And then the person, you know, 2 o'clock, not there. 2:10, they don't like me. 2:20, nobody loves me. 2:30, I hate the world. And so in a way, from this first one, like, you know, the person is not there on time, then actually, because it's unpleasant, then you can quickly go into making it extremely unpleasant. I mean, nowadays we have a mobile phone, so you can phone the person and the person generally send you a text and I am late or I'm stuck or this happened or whatever. So generally it can be sorted out. But it's interesting this, kind of how certain tonality from one event suddenly is kind of like, I am stuck. And then you go into this kind of for me or whatever it can be. And so in a way to see, oh, I'm going down there. What is going on here? I mean, one of the, long ago, I used to do this. I used to sit in meditation. And then I used to, because I was married to my husband, and I used to suddenly, I would sit in meditation and suddenly I would have this weird, kind of like funny, unpleasant, whatever feeling. And then I would start to imagine that my husband was going to die and what would I do if he died? And I had all kind of scenario. And then at the end of it, I was really like, you know, not so big, but nearly. And I would say, "Oh, my poor husband, poor husband." And then he would look at me and, "What's going on here?" Because he was totally fine. And so I used to do this until I recognized, but this is weird. He's alive now. What are you thinking of him dying? This is kind of a weird thing to do. And so I thought, but what can I do about this? And then I was sitting in meditation one day and I kind of could see the pattern arising. And then I thought, but what if I died? Because up to that time, I had not thought of that possibility. But I thought, what if I died? And then actually, I did not care because I would be dead and then there is nothing to imagine. And then I stopped totally doing it because I realized I need to enjoy him now and not kind of, you know, so in a way renouncing this weird kind of going down that path. So in a way it's kind of like sometime it happened by itself, but other time, yes, we might need what I call to creatively engage because it is dangerous. It can be harmful to go down that way. Then you have a wonderful, another sutta. And I thought a lot about this sutta because of COVID-19. I know in the United States, you have, it has been a little kind of different things in different states. In France, you know, everybody had to do the same thing. So as soon as COVID-19 happened and then we were totally confined, to me, what was amazing, two things were amazing for me during this confinement time, which happened several times. The first thing which I thought was amazing is that things still worked. We still had electricity, we still had water, we still could go to the supermarket. So in terms of surviving, I mean, we could survive. And then through that realizing that, oh, all the essential worker who was allowing me to survive. And so having great sympathy, great empathy, great gratitude toward them. But the other thing I found interesting in terms of the confinement was that the shop were closed. I mean, we could not move and also the shop were closed, which means that I have not bought in a year and a half, I have not bought any clothes. It doesn't mean that I buy lots of clothes because I am not too much into material thing. But what I can see every year is I need to find the perfect shirt. I need to find the perfect cotton cardigan. And so each year, there is this kind of looking for that one thing, this year I might find it. And so what was interesting is that this year I could not do this. So in a way I had to renounce my search for the perfect shirt or the perfect sweater or whatever it was. And what I discovered in a way renouncing that, because I did not go on the internet to get it, is that suddenly it's like nearly I rediscovered my wardrobe. That actually I have enough. I have enough shirt. I have enough cotton cardigan because every year you look for the perfect one. You don't find the perfect one, but you find which one, which kind of is close by. Because you have to buy one, you have to get one. This is interesting, that kind of wanting. And in a way, oh, I don't need it. I have enough. So in a way, in terms of renunciation, I think the other side of renunciation is contentment. And so you have this wonderful sutta. It's a short sutta in the numerical discourses. And in it, the Buddha says, oh, this is the great teaching, which is going to show us really what my disciples are made of. So the intro is really amazing because you really expect something like, you know, in order for you to be a real disciple of the Buddha, I mean, you must have an amazing awakening or you must have something amazing. But it's really kind of the intro is really kind of boosting the stuff, boosting what's going to happen. So you kind of, okay, what's needed to be a good, great disciple of the Buddha? Okay, let's see how tough is it? How possible is it? And then, and here he's really talking to the monks and the nuns. And he says, if you are contented with your food, and then he gives lots of example of how they were kind of being pickety about their food, the monks and the nuns. And then he said, also, if you are contented with your clothes, And then he showed different way the nuns and the monk were a little kind of pickety, kind of wanting better clothes or better this or better that. If you are contented with your lodging, and again, it seemed that the monks and the nun wanted to have, you know, maybe one or two windows, maybe some kind of, you know, nice little curtains or whatever. And he said, can you be content with the food you are given, with the clothes you are wearing, with the lodging you are in? And together with that, just to meditate. And in a way, that's all you need to be a true disciple of the Buddha. And I thought, this is so interesting. In terms of ourselves, can we be content with the food? Can we be content with our clothes? Can we be content with our lodging? And so I think this is the other side of renunciation, is contentment. And so in terms of renunciation, we can also look at meditation. When we meditate, so you've done some meditation today, so you sit in meditation or you lie down, whatever is the posture you take. And then generally you have something you focus on. So you might focus on the breath, you might focus on the body, on listening, you might do loving kindness meditation. And so in a way, one of the aim of the exercise, I know later on you're going to have for a month looking at samatha and vipassana. And so in a way for me, part of the practice is samatha, which is this focusing. But what happens when we do the focusing? And I think the focusing is actually very much about cultivating renunciation. Because what we notice when we meditate is that actually very quickly we think of something else. And this is what is interesting, is how soon do we come back? And how do we come back? And so in a way, what we are doing here is working with our habituation. If you sit in meditation, you can see, you might have noticed that most of the time, you don't have many original thoughts. You rarely have a thought you have never had before. If you look, when we're thinking, when we're sitting in meditation, generally lots of repetition. And so what we can notice, this is a fact, to me, that's why the meditation is beautiful, is because it's information. What do I think about? What is it I am caught in? And so what you can notice a mental habit, emotional habit, physical habits. And so like if we just look at mental habits, you can start to notice, oh yeah, I mean, for myself, I had a tendency to daydream, I had a tendency to ruminate, I had a tendency to plan. I mean, you have many different habits, but what are they, those habits? Actually, those habits are creative function to think, to reflect, to organize, but then they become habituated. So they become more fixed. It's kind of like it's like a loop. And so in a way, what is meditation? I would say a formal meditation is about cultivating renunciation. Renunciation in terms of looping, of being caught in our habits. And it doesn't mean that the thoughts are bad. No, the thoughts are not bad. What is tricky is the fact they're repetitive, they're a little fixated. So they're a little fixing you. And they're not very creative. And so in a way, each time we come back to the breath, to the sound, to the body, to the loving kindness, we actually, in a way, dissolving the repetition. and helping us to go back to the creative functioning. So in a way, you could say sitting in meditation, in a way, is dissolving. If we look at renunciation as dissolution, then it's dissolving the habituation so that you can bring it back to its creative functioning. And so in a way, personally, I think that's what meditation is a lot about. Not about stopping thought, but in a way, seeing the thought in a different way, but very importantly, bringing them back to the creative functioning. And there again, the habituation can go by itself. Like when I was thinking about my husband dying and deciding, you know, I don't need to do this anymore. What's the point? But certain habits are stronger. I know for myself, when I used to meditate, I mean, in Korea, we meditated a lot. And suddenly I realized I was spending my time daydreaming. And then over time, so I saw it, but it did not stop it. But over time, I became more aware that actually the daydreaming started with a tonality, very pleasant tonality. And the tonality was, if I had, if I was. And then I would go into, like, you know, this fantasy. I mean, one of my favorite one in Korea, I mean, in Korea, you sit a lot, 10 hours a day, 3 months at a time. And I would catch myself daydreaming about going to a hermitage, practicing very hard, becoming awakened and saving everybody. And suddenly I realized, wait a minute, I am daydreaming about meditating. This is not meditating. The other one was kind of becoming a kung fu mistress. And I used to have lots of film like heroic kung fu fantasy. And the one I stopped that one was actually by going to a kung fu class. And that was that. After that, I stopped. This is not for me. But I still did it, you know? And it took me a long time, till one day, this is what was interesting in terms of renunciation. So I did this for years, many years. And even when I was a teacher, I still did it after I stopped being a nun. And then one day I was teaching a retreat and I was, leading the meditation. And I was, sitting there leading the meditation and I could see the feeling tone of the, if I had, if I was. And during the whole sitting, I was determined, no way. I am not going to go there right now. So the whole sitting was about, if I had, if I was, no. Stay here. If I had, if I was not, you stay here. So the was actually quite a lot of energy, a lot of strength to just for the whole sitting, not daydreaming. And then after that, it never happened again. And I found that fascinating. Something I had been doing for 25 years. By just, in a way, deciding to renounce it and to stand firm, the power of it just went. And I could not do it anymore. Like I would sit in meditation and I can't do it. And to me, it was fascinating because it seems so real. It seems so strong. And in a way, by deciding to stand firm, it's like, poof, the power of it totally dissipated. So that was an interesting experience in terms of that. Also, when you will look into the Vipassana, Samatha and Vipassana, what is interesting also is to, with the questioning, you see, I think part of renunciation is not just saying no, but it's also being able to question, what am I thinking? And this is one of, in that sutta, the sutta of the Vitakasantana sutta, that's one of the method. The method to kind of not continue to cause harm is to question. And so in a way, sometimes this is interesting in terms of renunciation. You don't say no, but you question it. Like you question the story. Is this true? Is this always true? This is interesting when we say to ourselves, it's always like this. It will never change. But is this true? Can something last every second, every minute, every hour, every day? No. And in a way, this is a gift of impermanence, which can then really help in terms of the renunciation by not we don't need to negate. Sometimes we negate, it's useful, but sometimes we just need to question. Why am I thinking this? Could I think something else? Then also what is interesting is to look at what happened. Again, to back to dukkha, back to suffering. Because I think in a way, these are signals. For me, the meditation helps us to recognize the signal of what is harmful and to help us in a way to, one could say, creatively, wisely renounce. So again, this is, I love to organize. So I had a tendency to plan. I was a great planner. I mean, so bad that once when I lived in community, somebody really shouted at me, stop organizing us. So I was a bad organizer. I love to plan. And then many years ago, for our first international travel, I was planning all the time. You know, we were going for 3 months and we need this, we need that. And then I noticed suddenly I had pain in the stomach. Like pain in the stomach I had not had for a long, long time, many, many, many years. And then I realized, why do I have this pain in the stomach? Is acidity coming from the stress of planning nonstop? And then I thought, wait a minute. There is a pain of the stomach. There is this incessant planning. What do I choose? I think sometimes renunciation is, what do we choose? Do we, in a way, choose a pain or choose a liberation from the pain? And I thought, personally, I thought, it's not worth it. It's really not worth to have this pain in the stomach, this constant planning. And so, I just stopped planning. And so in a way to see kind of the connection, I think this is in a way interesting. The mindfulness helps us realize this is a signal. This is a harmful habit. Can I let go of it? So I like to finish. I mean, before I finish with what I call the four stages of letting go, just something that with the COVID-19, personally, I felt the COVID-19, all my practice had been to deal with it in a creative, wise, compassionate way. And so when it happened, I decided different things. I decided first, I was going to be grateful for all the essential workers. Secondly, I was not going to stress about anything because I'm the person who likes to organize and be busy. And I decided no need to be busy anymore. You're stuck here anyway. Why be busy? What's the point? Take each day as it comes. And the one thing also I looked at was relationship. How do we relate to each other? Within a family, with friends, within a partnership, animals, etc. And I decided, oh, maybe this is an opportunity to deal with things differently. And this is something I learned long ago, but suddenly I thought, oh, I had forgotten it. Many years ago, I suddenly found myself nagging my husband. And I thought, wait a minute, my mother does that. I don't like it. He's not going to like it either. So then I decided I am not going to do that ever again, which I have not done for a very, very long time. But I was very stressed for some time because I was taking care of my mother who had Alzheimer's. And so I was becoming stressed. I was starting to be kind of a little less friendly. And situation have changed. Now we have a care worker. And so I was less stressed. And I thought, I am less stressed. I have a better situation. Can I have a different relationship? And what I found interesting now within relationship is that I think, yeah. I mean, you could be upset about this, but you don't need to. And so again, I find, oh yeah, this is fine. It's okay. And to me, what is interesting is to see that, oh yeah, I can see why at other time, other people could be upset about this. But do I need to be upset about this? And this, I think, is also in terms of relationship. How do we cultivate harmless, beneficial relationship? And I think partly is to renounce resentment. This is an interesting one, resentment, which often has to do with the past. Can we let go of the past and really creatively engage with the moment? But of course, with wisdom and compassion. And so I wanted to finish with, in terms of letting go, to see that letting go, renunciation can have many different aspects. It's not just one thing. And so that's why I had kind of this idea of the four stages of letting go. And that each stage is as important as the other. Because often we have the impression that letting go is like, you drop it. No matter what it is, you drop it. And you can't. According to conditions, sometimes you can drop it. A lot of the time you can't. So I think we have to see this letting go in a more creative way. And so that's why I would say there is kind of the one of the stages of letting go is what I call after. You become upset, you caught up in the reactive habits, and then like all thing, it stops and you don't experience it anymore. And if you practice mindfulness and you're aware of impermanence, you realize, oh, I am not upset anymore. I found that so fascinating, that moment. You were upset, and now you're not upset. Just to be so aware of that. That actually the fact that it's gone, because of impermanence, it's gone. And then just to be aware, oh, it's gone. It's like your organism has let it go. Then you have another stage where you're actually caught in the upset. You're caught in the reactivity. and you're so aware that you're caught in the reactivity. And this is generally, if you have meditated enough, then you really become aware, oh yes, I am reactive now. I am angry, I am afraid, I'm jealous, I am this, I am that. And you're very aware of it. And the emotion and the thought. And the thing is that awareness is not magic. So the fact that you're aware does not stop it. That's why you're so frustrated. Because before we enjoyed it, I enjoy being angry or sad or fearful or whatever. I'm kind of really in it. But because you're aware, it's like, oh, I am in it. I am aware of it and I cannot stop it because it's reactive, because something happened. But if you see it and you're aware of it, you're not going to amplify it. And that will help it to be less intense, to last less long. And in a way, that is a letting go, to be aware, oh, this is what is going on. But it has to go through the body and mind. And then if I don't amplify it, then at some point, it's going to stop. Then you have another type of letting go. And this is when you start to learn what triggers you. And so you realize you're not always upset, afraid, sad, angry, whatever it is. But generally, it comes upon different conditions coming together. Generally, you have a trigger, you have a contact, and you have what I call contributing factors. Stress, sleeplessness, different things like that. But then if you recognize the conditions, then actually you can choose to do something which will help you not to get stuck in the condition. Like going for a walk, like talking to somebody, like different people have different creative way to deal with their different triggers, different difficult conditions. And then you have another stage. And this is when, before you react, you realize you're going to react. And this is very interesting. And this is actually one of the points about meditating, is building the power of creative awareness so that you can have that type of letting go. So you have the condition, you have the trigger, and you're going to react. And something within you says, this happened to me. I used to have this tendency, if somebody hurt me, I would freeze them out. I would not talk to them, I would not look at them for days. And then as I meditated, it was like, when I was young, it was like 2 weeks. And then as I meditated, it became a little less, but still I used to do it. And then one day somebody hurt me, and then we were in community. It was a morning. I was in the going toward the kitchen. I could hear a voice, and then I could feel the reactivity come up, the freezing coming up. And then something within me saying, but could not you do something different? And then this fear, how can I do something different? I've never done anything different. And then in a way, the power of the creative awareness gave me the courage to go beyond the fear. And I think that's why we don't change sometimes, is a fear of the unknown. It's nearly like we prefer the pain of the known than the fear of the unknown. So I went beyond the fear. I go into the kitchen. I smile at the lady who had hurt me. And then I felt this ease. It's like, ah. And then I thought, but why did not I do this before? Why did I wait all these years? But then I could never do it again. And I could not do it. So I renounced that reactivity because of compassion. Because only then did I realize how painful it must have been for the other people to be frozen, to be not talked to be not looked at. How terrible. I mean, I was thinking just of protecting myself, but when I was protecting myself, I was hurting them. And after that, I could not do it because it was not compassionate. So I found other ways to deal with difficult situations. So this, but to see that these kind of, you know, they are different letting go, let it be before, let it be after, in the middle, in the beginning. But all of that, I think, is part of this creatively wise renunciation, compassionate letting go. So that's what I wanted to share with you today.